the real, the street life drama. Ayo, I grew up rough in the streets of Boston, Massachusetts, lived real ruthless. A wild kid, out to get a bid, did some shit that he never should've did. But he paid the price, lived real trife, ruined his life, and lived by the knife. Had to learn the hard way, but someday you gotta pay. So what the hey I say?
Life in the streets, it's an easy. All I see is pain and misery. I live and pray for the victory. Strength and protection to survive in this society.
This is Comics Therapy, episode 53. No reviews, just analysis. Up this week, two comics from August 6th, 2014. Genius number 1 and Street Angel number 3. As always, we have your nerd confessions, and on the couch, we welcome artist and writer Ulysses Farinas. Just as a reminder, we never do reviews, but we do talk a lot, so there may be spoilers ahead.
Hey there, Andrew and Aaron. This is Chase Magnet, writer at Comics Bulletin and comicbook.com, at Reverend Magnet on the Twitter. Calling in with my nerd confession. I can't help but feel like this week's question was tailor-made for my favorite comic store. Last week at San Diego Comic-Con, something very, very cool happened. My local comic store, Legend Comics and Coffee, was recognized at the Eisner Awards for something that I and other Omaha natives have known for a very long time, for being the best comic book store in the world. I was lucky enough to represent Legend at the ceremony and was able to share why I love it with everyone present. But I'm never going to grow tired of talking about this wonderful job. I first found Legend after returning to Omaha from college. I went there on a recommendation and instantly fell in love. It's a warm, welcoming, and well-staffed place. You can spend hours on the coffee side of the store working on projects and reading comic books, or do the same in the comic section. It's well-stocked with a diverse array of titles, everything from the biggest of events to small local comics. It was instantly my new home away from home. But that's not the real magic of Legend. The real magic is that it's home to so many people. Omaha is a diverse city, and every shape, size, color, and age is represented in the Legend Legion. What Dave, Joe, Jason, and Wendy, along with their amazing staff, have made is a store that embodies both their community and an essential truth about comics. That comics are for everybody. I'm getting a little bit misty-eyed, and we just got done celebrating a few hours ago. So I'll leave it at that, and raise one more glass today for Legend, my favorite place on Earth. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to Comics Therapy. Neither Aaron nor I are licensed therapists, so I'm really not sure why you're listening to us anyway. Unless you missed us, because I kind of did miss us. It's been like 2 weeks, so if I'm a little off my game this episode, I blame that. And as a creature of habit, I didn't really consider the dire consequences of taking a week off from the show. It will probably only go downhill from here. Anyway, this week's theme is On the Streets Where You Live. There's even a great song from the musical My Fair Lady that we could have used for the intro music. But of course, Aaron vetoed that because he hates joy.
You have a very loose description of great.
Well, you have a very loose description of joy.
Fair enough. Go on.
Also, because he is a creature of habit, because he's a robot, that's why we, week after week, fight about the music, and week after week, Aaron wins. Because I let him. Really?
Sure. Yeah.
Anyway, we are today looking at two characters this week who live on and are masters of the streets. One, a tactician on the wrong side of the law, and the other, a skateboarding vigilante. Both happen to be young and female, by the way, which is kind of awesome.
Sure, whatever. I don't see race or gender, but if you have to point that out, that's cool.
This is going to be a terrible discussion that is going to alienate everybody.
In between comic segments, your very own nerd confessions, celebrating what we love and occasionally what we snark about comics. This week, we invited you to shout out your favorite local comic shop, partially because we're focused on neighborhood stories, and partially to celebrate our friends at Legend Comics and Coffee in Omaha, Nebraska, on their recent Eisner win. Each episode, you can call, Skype, or email your confessions to us. The details are on the website, comicstherapy.com. Remember, catharsis is cool.
Hi guys, it's your old friend Mike Garvey here from the Sullivan Garvey This Could Be Fub podcast, calling with my confession that my favorite comic store is Comics Etc. here in Brisbane. They're just an awesome bunch of guys, and they do trade paperbacks at US prices, which saves on our shitty conversion rate. Anyway, yeah, they're awesome. And they've got some great stuff there. So yeah, there we go. See ya.
In between shows, you can find me on Twitter, at Andrea Schock, and Aaron, at Aaron Myers. The show account is at Comics Therapy. So Aaron, I feel like you have a bunch of really rad comic shops near you. We've talked about it before because you buy a lot of comics. But are there any specifically that you want to call out by name?
Well, the two main stores I go to are both owned by the same person. Does that count?
Yes. Do they have two different names?
They have two different names.
Then just say them both.
Okay, so it's Emerald City Comics and Nostalgia Collectibles in Eugene, Oregon.
Right on.
Both owned by Daryl Grimes, who had opened the first comic book shop in Oregon 40-plus years ago.
Like the first in the entire state?
Apparently. Like the first truly dedicated comic book shop.
Cool.
Like, you know, there were stores, like dime stores and, you know, convenience stores and things that sold comics, but nothing that was specifically a comic book store.
Is he still around and, like, involved in the day-to-day business stuff?
Yep, so he manages Nostalgia, and Stu is the manager of Emerald City, who started working for him. I just found this out recently, actually. He started working for him 25 years ago. He just came in and said he wanted to work there, and Daryl said he wasn't sure he wanted to have anyone working in the store, and Stu said, well, I'll work for free. And Daryl said, well, I can't just have you work for free. And then Stu said, well, fine, I'll work for credit. And so...
I will work for comics.
Yes. He just wanted to hang out in a comic book store and be able to work there. And now he manages Emerald City pretty much autonomously. Like, it's very strange. They're both owned by Daryl, but I don't think Daryl really... He doesn't really involve himself in what goes over at the other store.
Okay.
So it's kind of an interesting arrangement. So they're both a little different, and they're in different parts of town, so they kind of have a different clientele focus. I like going to both on Wednesday for different reasons.
Do they both have new comics?
Yeah, they both have new comics. They both have pull boxes and subscribers, but the Emerald City is right next to the university, so it has more student traffic.
Got it.
And then Nostalgia is downtown, and I'd say it has kind of an older clientele and people that are more collectors.
Okay.
Because when Daryl opened the second store, he moved all, like, the anything 1975 or older from his back stock went over to Nostalgia with him.
So when you are posting pictures of bin diving finds, they're mostly from the second one?
Really depends. I go into Nostalgia probably more because I'm allowed inner circle access into the back stock. Like,
oh,
I can go
God.
Look through it myself. But Emerald City's too small, so, like, it's a very much smaller space, so the backstock area is pretty cramped and kind of dangerous, so only Stu goes back there.
Okay.
So it's nice to be able to go to Nostalgia and just kind of, like, browse through.
I feel like it would be tragic yet appropriate if you were crushed by long boxes.
I mean, that's the dream.
Right. At home or in a shop.
Yeah, whichever.
Right.
Okay. Doesn't matter. So those are my new and main back issue places, but there are five other places in town that I would say I frequent on a semi-regular basis.
Can I ask you a question, like, drop the inner circle bullshit thing for a second and answer this honestly.
Uh-huh.
I know it's going to be a stretch, but like, sincerely, do you have, like, a known reputation in town as a collector?
I don't think anyone would know me. Like, I would say I've been going to, like, Nostalgia and Emerald City for 5 years now. And I don't know if anyone could, like say, oh, I know Aaron. Like, if I went in, they would say, yes, they recognize me.
Wow.
But,
okay.
Yeah, names don't come up in conversation a lot.
Okay.
And you're just a number, a box number.
Yeah, but, like, you spend a phenomenal amount of time and money there. And I feel like you often have these stories of the conversations that you have with, like, other patrons while you're there. And it's just surprising to me that some of the banter about comics that you maintain online wouldn't translate to in a shop.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm very weird with people face to face.
I wasn't trying to get you to say that, although, okay.
I would say compared to some other clientele, I'm probably like middle of the road weird, but right. At the same time, like if I go into nostalgia, now that I don't have to ask anyone to look for back issues, I just walk back. And like a lot of the time, like Daryl won't even see me or anything. Like I'll kind of pop out with like a stack of stuff that I wanted and be like, oh, I didn't even see you come in. And I'll just make a joke like how I'm like the shadow or I'm a thief in the night or something like that, you know?
Right.
Yeah, but...
Which one do you take the boys to?
If we go, it'd probably be nostalgia because there's room. It gets kind of cramped over at Emerald City.
Got it.
And there's just way too much stuff that can get pulled off the shelves. It's like a little easier to manage kids over at Nostalgia.
Okay.
But that doesn't happen that often because, there's only so much tolerance. Or we'll go to Blue Moon Books, which is a bookstore. And it's a much less like comic booky environment.
Okay.
Yeah, and there's a lot more, like, kids' comics for them to, for Luke to go through.
Excellent.
Yeah, so that's my local shout-out, I guess.
Yay.
Uh-huh. What about you?
Well, it's interesting because, like, I've been reading exclusively digitally except for trades or, like, occasionally things that I would pick up at a con. That comes at, like, the expense of going up to Mission Comics and Art, which is owned and... managed by Leif Smith up in the Mission in San Francisco, and he's awesome. And so I miss that place. He also has an art gallery, and he does like a lot of events, and it's just a really cool space. But for lots of reasons, I sort of switched over to digital. But as Avi is starting to read more and more, it's actually easier for him to read in print, and he prefers it. So go ahead, make your comments.
No, I think that's great. I think he's a smart kid.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, not every child has to make the same follies of their parents.
Right, okay. Got it. Yep. But what that means is that I have a greater...
I mean, he has an appreciation for, the printed word.
Uh-huh.
He's not killing the publishing industry.
Right. Are you done? Because I was going to finish what I was saying.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, yeah. It does mean that now...
He appreciates the tactile...
Yeah.
Feel of the comics page as he experiences the, the story.
He does. Yep. Anything else?
Yeah. No, I'm done.
Okay. So, I think that means...
Immersing himself in the story with each turn, each flip of the page.
You're adorable.
Go on.
So, we are going to start going to the shop more frequently. And there are a couple that are closer to us in San Mateo, like Lee's Comics. But when you find a shop like Mission Comics and Art, that's kind of fantastic. Sometimes it's worth the drive. So it's like a 20-minute drive as opposed to a 4-minute drive. And, it's worth it. I think I have a whole new list of books for Avi. He turned 9 a couple of weeks ago and I guess has made a bit of a leap in terms of what he is interested in and the questions that he's asking. And it made me re-examine some of the comics that he was reading. Much of the like really high quality all ages stuff that's not Marvel and DC is still super fantastic for him. And he loves, especially like the Kartoja Tales anthologies when they come. Mm-hmm. And he loves the Aw Yeah comic stuff when that comes. And those were both Kickstarters and they come to the house. And so it's like really low maintenance for me. But I have put together a list of some other more recent Marvel titles, like asked for some suggestions, not necessarily all the things that I am reading. And even non-Marvel stuff that I think he's ready for. And so I think that's going to be like the next step is like maybe even putting a little like pool box together for him.
Maybe. That's exciting.
It is. I don't want to get like overzealous with that because it's going to, I don't want to basically replicate the same situation that had me kind of turning to digital. But... I think that having a handful of regular titles that are sort of his to manage could be really cool for him. So I need to...
What do you think about getting like a previews book monthly for him to look through too.
Is there a previews book that is less overwhelming than like the full one? Is there a kid's version? I don't think so.
No, there should be. But there should be. Could be a fun, like, I don't know, you and him kind of activity.
I think more realistically, I can do some, like, pre-culling and offer him a couple of options. And we can look at it together online, but rather than, like, handing him the whole book. Like, he's not ready for that. Maybe in another year or so.
Mm-hmm.
I would love for him to actually be ready for that. But, like, he's still just 9, and I still need to, like, not bite off more than I can chew and not get, like, all caught up in the fact that I want to share all the things with my kid.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I gotta be realistic here. So I have, like, 5 titles that we're gonna start with. Maybe not all 5 of them immediately, but those are the ones that we're gonna kind of explore and see which of them really sticks with him and like what else he wants to do from there.
That's exciting.
It is. It's very cool. Yeah.
I've been reading a lot of like Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck comics with Luke lately.
Mm-hmm.
But he turned a little bit of a point recently too, like where if he's not taking a nap anymore, he'll go in his room for a little bit of quiet time, and we moved his short box into his room.
Right.
And now he's like taking comics out and looking through them, you know, quietly on his bed, which is, you know, by himself.
Mm-hmm.
So that's fun.
Yeah.
It's so, you know, they're growing up, these kids.
They do that.
Yeah, I guess so.
I want to make sure that, like, I took Avi to see Guardians.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want him to lose the excitement of the, like, Marvel Universe. Just because not all of the titles that he's interested in are quite appropriate for him. And it's interesting because we were talking recently about like what that actually means. Like appropriate for kids, just for a point of clarification, for me can also be that the story itself is too sophisticated. Like it's not just the content is questionable. Right. It's like a lot of it is just too convoluted or too complicated or requires like too much kind of prior knowledge, and I don't want to turn him off to any of it because I pick the wrong thing for him to jump into.
That's fair.
Yeah.
It's also necessary these days to do that kind of, I guess, tailoring of comics because mm-hmm. it's not the same as it was where kids discovered comics by, you know, going to the grocery store and begging, you know, to pick one out of, you know, out of the spinner rack. Where now it's like you have to go to a comic book store to get them, and most kids don't have a comic book store within like walking or bike riding distance.
Right. Right.
So, yeah, it's too bad in that way that self-discovery process is a little bit stifled.
It is, but I also think that there's a bunch of stuff out right now that is actually more approachable than I thought it was.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, we've got a lot of resources amongst our friends for suggestions, really solid, strong arguments in favor or against something right now or, like, waiting a couple of years or whatever.
Sure. Yeah. No, there's lots of choices. It's yeah. I'm sure you'll be fine. I think it's going to be okay.
I think it's going to be great, as a matter of fact.
Can we stop Kids Cast for a little while and maybe talk about why you couldn't do a show last week?
Wow. Way to just fucking throw down, dude.
Well, I think you owe everyone an explanation. So you went on a little vacation.
Yes. I went to San Diego Comic-Con. Everybody knows that.
Oh, boy, do we.
Yep.
And you were so tired from it that you couldn't do a show for everyone.
It's not entirely true.
Pretty true.
I
think the exact quote I got from you was, "I don't care about you. I don't care about them. I'm back from SDCC. Screw you all. I'm going to sleep."
That sounds not at all like me.
Well, I think you've come to your senses since then.
Uh-huh. I think if you went back and actually read the actual quote, well, maybe you shouldn't do that.
No.
Yes, so I went to San Diego Comic-Con.
And you had a magical time?
I had a magical time. Sure. Yeah, it's much like going to Vegas for the first time is a bit like going to another planet.
Mm-hmm.
So is San Diego Comic-Con.
Yeah, it's big.
It is. I was very well prepared.
Yeah.
Yeah, like there's no way that I would have done that trip without like the expertise that I had in my back pocket.
Mm-hmm.
Roderick prepared me very well. I had all of my supplies organized. I had all my stuff downloaded to the phone. I had an understanding of the layout. We had like a game plan for preview night. It was very successful. And actually, because Image did their expo that day, they had a whole bunch of the creators who had announced projects available for preview night. The access to the creators during preview night for Image specifically was like really fucking cool.
Good.
And not something that was necessarily like available later in the weekend.
Uh-huh. When it finally starts getting pretty crazy.
Yeah.
And I heard mixed things, but I know every year Artist Alley gets squeezed more and more.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like people still have decent amount of traffic and attention.
I cannot speak for it from a creator perspective, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a physical division between the main floor and Artist Alley. And
yeah,
that's always going to trip people up.
See, I love that personally. That's what makes me want to go more, because it feels like that it's almost, I mean, in a way, and I love to use this term, that makes it inner circle.
Oh my God, Aaron. It doesn't, actually.
But it kind of does in a way that, because if there's not a natural flow to the traffic, the people there that are there for cosplay and for movie premiere stuff aren't going to really make their way over to it.
Well,
and
but that,
it's not good for creators, but it's good for it's good for you.
No, it's not just that, like, Artist Alley exclusively is separate. I mean, a lot of the, like, toys and, like, video game stuff and, like, there's a separate exhibition hall, not just Artist Alley, like not just comics.
Okay.
Like
no, that's too bad.
Little collectible toys and shit. I mean, that's all in a separate. Basically, what I'm saying is you cannot walk from one end to the other without going into the lobby. Like, if you're an idiot and you don't realize that you have to go back inside, then you're going to miss out on that. But, like, I don't think that that's the case for too many people.
Well, or I think there is a group of people, and I would say maybe it's 50-50 or something like that, but there's a group of people that really don't have any interest in seeing too many comics creators or doing back issue buying or anything like that.
That's not the same as not, that's choosing to not take advantage of something.
Yeah.
That's not the same as like not going there.
Sure. No,
I mean, I talked to a couple of people who were like, where's Artist Alley? Well, once you figure out where it is, it's really fucking big and not easy to miss.
Yeah.
I mean, so for the record, I skipped Hall H and that entire experience.
Well,
and I don't
regret
it.
Because you have to wait so long.
Well, so I think one of the most important things that, like, Rod and I talked about before the con is that, like, your time is your greatest resource. And so if you know about something that you want to see and can plan in advance to ensure that you see it, then you have to start calculating what you're going to sacrifice between now and then in order to wait for it. And if you look at the schedule for Hall H, it wasn't worth it. It wasn't worth it for me.
No, you have to spend half your time just waiting to get into a panel.
Right. I did do a bunch of panels, like Image panels and DC and Vertigo and Marvel and like a bunch of general panels. And then I specifically went to the Lock and Key panel with Joe Hill and Gabriel Rodriguez that I was stoked about, which was awesome. And then we hit up their signing on Sunday morning. But that was like the big thing on my San Diego bucket list. So I like did it. I based other things around having access to that.
Did you have to wait long to get into those?
Well, because of the way that they stack the schedule, there was a Whedon focused panel before the Lock and Key panel.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a long wait, but then the room emptied out. So
Oh, okay.
I waited for through most of the previous panel because of that. But all that did was ensure that I had a really good seat for the panel that I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So that was worth it.
Smart.
Thanks for asking about my panel, by the way.
Oh, yeah. How'd your panel go?
Uh-huh. Yeah, it went well. Thanks.
Well, nobody sent me a video, so I wasn't even sure it happened.
It did, and I want to thank several of our listeners, more than several, actually. It was like a shocking number of people who came that I actually knew, and I hope that nobody was disappointed that it was like a semi-serious education panel and not my like typical irreverence. But it was very cool to see friendly faces in the crowd because I was very nervous.
Yeah, but you did well.
I think I did fine.
And you, people are happy with you?
I think that people are happy with me. You know that it's important to me to like do a check-in with everybody around me to make sure I didn't wildly fuck up. Right. And if all of them lied to me, then that's a thing. But I don't think that they all did. They didn't like get together to plan to tell me that I fucked up. So
well, see, this is why I wanted video, so I could tell you honestly how you did.
Thanks.
But now I can't.
Right.
So that's on you.
You know what?
You want to talk about some comics?
I mean, anything that you want to talk about with Guardians of the Galaxy?
I want to talk about that next week.
Okay. Why? Because we talked too long about other things?
Yes.
Fine. Aaron, it's been 2 weeks, and I, as much as, like, we kind of play up the fact that we hate each other, I don't actually hate you. I kind of missed chatting with you.
I
don't hate you
either. I missed it as well.
You just want to move on to the comics. Feelings. Let's talk about comics.
Yeah, this is making me terribly uncomfortable.
Okay, let's do it.
All right.
Hey, guys. This is James Kaplan, SinisterJHK on Twitter. And I really love this question because I feel really fortunate to have a number of great shops in my area. However, my favorite shop is the shop that is closest to me, so I'm very lucky. It's called The Outer Limits, and it's in Waltham, Massachusetts. And the owner has been in business there for almost 30 years. And it's a great shop. They have a huge variety of stuff. They have back issues, though that's not really my thing. They have a nice kids section, and they just have a lot of variety of stuff. But what makes it great is Steve, the owner. He's an awesome guy. He and I are buddies on Facebook. I send him my list of what books I want on a weekly basis, and he, you know, it works really well. It's very easy for me. And I love my Wednesday routine. I go into the shop Wednesday after work, and there's just a group of folks that I see every week, and it's fun. We talk, we catch up, we talk comics, movies, TV, etc., and it's just a great time, and it's a real gift I get. I'm very fortunate to have such a great shop that is right near me. Thanks.
Our first book this week is Genius Number 1, written by Mark Bernardini and Adam Freeman, and drawn by Afua Richardson. Lettering is by Troy Pateri. Genius is published by Image Comics' Top Cow imprint.
Mark Bernardin, Adam Freeman, Afua Richardson. Just for
I was pretty close.
Nope. Not even a little bit.
Well, tell me about this book.
Okay. This is from the solicit. Alexander, Hannibal, Napoleon, Patton. What if the greatest military mind of our generation was born in strife, surrounded by violence and combat since birth? When the gauntlet is dropped, the question isn't, how did 17-year-old Destiny Adjei unite the gangs of South Central into a killer army and declare war on the LAPD? No. The question is, can anyone stop her?
It's a good solicit.
Yeah. Yeah. I think this book is really exciting because it takes a lot of things that we would expect and turns them upside down. And I enjoy that.
Tell me about that.
Okay. So, we have the premise, obviously, of this kind of military genius being this young female who lives in South Central LA. And we have a little bit of insight into like the primary LAPD analyst who has been predicting the rise of a similar like military genius on the gang side of things. And I think it's really interesting that he's looking for a man and that they're looking for like a combat vet. And there are all sorts of
like
more
assumptions.
Typical, yeah, assumptions. And yet what we have is this young woman who has taken it upon herself to put herself into this position of power. And I think actually one of the strongest sequences in this book was the description from the analyst and then the reality of Destiny's life back mm-hmm. and forth, and seeing where he was right versus where he was wrong, and seeing the specifics of the things that she did and the choices that she made as she gained the trust of some of the other guys, and like how she used her body in her favor and was always in control and was smarter than the people who would detract her. There's this like moment where she's taking a test in like middle school, and she has to identify which country wasn't one of the Axis powers. And you can see that she had originally circled Portugal, and then she erases it and circles Germany, so as not to draw attention to the fact that she's smarter than she seems.
Mm-hmm.
I think little moments like that make her character really interesting. I read some stuff about the creative process for this book and how, like, she's, you're not supposed to necessarily root for her in a traditional way, because she's not good. Like, she's fucking killing people. And yet...
Yeah, she's not a genius. She's a sociopath.
Well, I mean, are those two things mutually exclusive?
No, you can be a genius without being a murderer or disassociating yourself from feelings.
But look at, like, her motivation.
Sure. I think the motivations described in here seem convenient and might seem somewhat altruistic. Like a greater good. And it goes back to the description too. Like, I think a lot of dictators, military leaders, that sort of thing, there's a megalomania that comes along with that what they are doing is for the greater good, when ultimately it's for themselves.
Absolutely. And so I think that some of the stuff that I was reading from the creators' standpoint, kind of putting this character into perspective, like, this is a villain, and there are things about her that are very appealing, but you're right, like, she's,
well, yeah, a lot of villains have sympathetic origin stories,
and not necessarily just the origin story being sympathetic, the actions that she's taking. I mean, like, rooting for the quote-unquote bad guy when they're totally kicking the good guy's ass, that's like a trope in and of itself that is that can actually be like a lot of fun.
Sure. I didn't think I had as much fun reading this maybe than you did.
Is it because you hate women?
I mean, no, that's not only why. No, but, well, this is a hard discussion, I think, for us to have, because we don't have very much perspective as a couple of just, you know, white middle-class people on, you know, the struggle and the things you have to go through in kind of harder environments. You know, what kind of person that makes you. It's also interesting to have a female character kind of rise as one of these, because from all those examples, like, I don't know of a historical example of a female military leader or a female kind of tactical leader in this capacity.
Right.
You know? So it's an interesting way of breaking a stereotype that maybe historically has never happened. So you gotta wonder how, if it's something that is supposed to be that, you know, it's like this Elseworlds story that's plausible, it's a leap that I don't have much real world evidence to connect to.
I feel like you're talking out of both sides of your mouth here. Because on the one hand, you're looking for real-world examples. But on the other hand, you're stating definitively that you don't have that real-world perspective.
No, I'm looking for real-world examples of how a person, a female, would rise to a position like this. And at the same time, I don't feel that I can judge how a person, regardless of race or gender, living in an economic situation like this, could what measures they would take to ensure their own safety and ensure their own power in that regard. Does that make sense?
It does. I feel like we're swapping roles this week.
That's fine.
How apropos.
Yeah, well, this is, I guess, the exception to that then.
Huh. No, I think that we have, like, a strong black female lead character who doesn't necessarily make all of the right choices. She's not a fucking princess. There's nothing admirable about her actions, yet there's something very striking about the mastery of those actions.
Mm-hmm.
And well, I find that really appealing. Because so far, like, she's killed a bunch of guys. She's brought a bunch of disparate gangs together. She is in charge, and, like, no one is messing with her. And I'm really excited to see what that actually means throughout the course of this miniseries. Because you're right. There are a lot of things historically that would say this is not sustainable. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of things that would be typically not in her favor. So at what point does this become just pure fantasy? And we're not there yet. And so I'm sort of interested in, like, how you balance the reality of a story, like, rooted in conflict on the streets and, you know, very real, like, antagonistic relationships between communities and those sworn to protect them. And, like, what's happening in this book?
Yeah, and it's, I think a lot of it's premature to judge the story. You know, I'm talking about first impressions after this first issue. It's, I think this will be worth, you know, whether we talk about it on the show or we just talk about it, seeing how we feel at the end of the miniseries too.
Did you read the pilot?
No.
You should read the pilot, and then we can talk about it more.
Sure, but I'm just going off the basis of reading just this one issue and the things it made me think about. And that doesn't mean I'm disagreeing or I'm saying, oh, well, this is how I would have written it. It's just the things that it made me think about.
Would you feel differently if the main character wasn't female?
I think it would be more plausible, and it would fit my expectations.
I'm so, like, struck by your reliance on plausibility for this story.
I don't
Why isn't it just fucking awesome that it's this, like, 17-year-old girl who's brilliant and has the big picture understanding of not only the relationships within her world, but in those who are, like, trying to suppress it?
I mean, I guess honestly, because it doesn't seem that smart to me. So I want to see how the rest of it plays out to feel differently.
Okay.
Because tactically, it's not the approach I would take.
Yeah, but
if I were her.
Okay.
So that's all. It's just what it's
You're
how
not
I'm
a
feeling.
Tactical genius, by the way.
You don't know that.
I do.
I've convinced you to do a show with me every week.
That's a whole different.
That's what you think.
Okay.
Just my little puppet.
Huh. Let me know when you're ready to take down the, like, Eugene police force with your podcast.
I am not interested in doing that now, nor will I ever be for any any law enforcement officials who may be listening to the show.
Also, he has a bunker with a lot of guns and some MREs, and
I have just a couple of guns in a gun safe and just a few MREs for the zombie apocalypse. And that by Eugene standards and by Oregon standards is not even a survival kit.
See, you're not actually a tactical genius.
Or am I? Do you want to talk about our next book?
You're, like, really not in agreement with me at all about this.
No.
Wow.
Do we have to agree with everything?
Not at all. But it's really, really cool when we don't.
Yeah. So, you know, that's why it's hard for me to talk about issue ones sometimes. Because it's just a first impression. It's a 4-issue miniseries. There's a lot of growth and discovery and hopefully reveal to go.
Should have read the pilot.
Well, should have done a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
Should we talk about our next book?
Yes, absolutely.
Let's do that.
Hey, Comics Therapy. This is Brian in Omaha, Nebraska, calling in this week with my nerd confession about our LCS. And, of course, I'm here in Omaha. I'm going to brag about Legend Comics and Coffee. It's a great place. I actually haven't been reading comics for all that long, maybe a year and a half. And this comic store was actually the place that got me interested in comics to begin with. It was part of when they moved and opened up a coffee shop across the place where we would go every morning for breakfast, and we would walk across the street, get coffee in their coffee store. And I got kind of poking around at the comic books. It has the Legend staff is fantastic, and would start talking to us, asking us about what we liked. They're never really pushy or made us feel kind of alienated about comics. And ended up started picking up a couple issues here and there that kind of evolved into developing a pull list. And what makes Legend great as well is that it's not just a store where they try to sell and push you comic books. It's a place where you can go and hang out and feel like you belong. I'm sure people have called in already about Legend with the recent Eisner winning that they did in San Diego Comic-Con. And one of the Legend regulars, when he was there doing the acceptance speech for the Eisner, said that the Legend comic store really exists because comics are for everyone. And it is a place where people from all different walks of life and all different passions and places can come, whether it's for trivia night or comedy night or creator workshops, and just go spend time with one another and create things and enjoy the art form that everybody loves. The staff, I not having a very big pull list and not being in there all that often, they still make every effort to know your name. And so after a few short weeks, the staff there knows who you are, will get your comics ready for you, will talk to you, ask you about how things in your life are going. And it's just an incredibly welcoming place. Joe is always there with a friendly remark or conversation, or whoever's behind the desk helping you out. So that's my LCS, Legend Comics and Coffee in Omaha, Nebraska, and the fantastic owners and staff that we have there. Thank you, guys. Love the show.
Our second book this week is Street Angel number 3, created by Jim Rugg and Brian Maruca. Street Angel is being digitally republished by Monkey Brain Comics. The hardcover edition, collecting all the previous issues, was released by Ad House Books this week.
Okay, so this is another quote from the solicit. Orphaned by the world, raised by the streets, Jesse Sanchez is a dangerous martial artist and the world's greatest homeless skateboarder. In Wilkesboro, Angel City's worst ghetto, she fights ninjas, drugs, nepotism, and pre-algebra as Street Angel. Time-traveling conquistadors, Ireland's first astronaut, and Inti, the Incan sun god, descend on Angel City, prompting an epic street fight with ninja West Side Story style. Can Street Angel untangle this mess in time to restore history and destruction of the Incan Empire, or is this the end of our diminutive homeless heroine? That's actually just the description from the second one.
Yeah.
The third one...
The third one this week was awesome.
It was so awesome. The third one is about Jesse fights the devil, Jesus gets involved, and then she wakes up at the end.
Yep.
It was great. I fucking love this book.
It has some... There's a lot of things about Street Angel that remind me of Amy Racecar.
Okay.
You haven't read Stray Bullets, so you wouldn't understand that.
Nope.
But someday when you read Stray Bullets, you will understand what I mean about that.
Okay.
So...
It reminds me a little bit of King City also.
Yeah, sure. It has elements of both. Mm-hmm. But it's this, what's reality and what isn't doesn't really matter in this book. I don't know. It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
It's insanity. It's, I love the idea of like this, somebody being this just unstoppable, I don't know, like force, I guess.
Okay.
Who's a child.
So why does plausibility not matter in Street Angel?
Because the universe, it makes you, forces you to accept that absurdity is the norm from the get-go.
Okay.
Whereas our previous book is set in a quote-unquote real-world scenario. There's nothing real-world about Street Angel. So once you start reading it, you go like, okay, there's no rules. You know, fine. Right. Time-traveling conquistadors can show up. Sure.
Right.
You know, she can get touched by the hand of God and given the power to chop the devil's head off with a skateboard. Spoiler alert.
Well, but that was a dream.
Or was it? Like, who knows?
Okay.
Right?
I need to shout out Chris Robertson, by the way, who co-publisher at Monkey Brain Comics and mentioned this book to me recently and said, like, hey, you should check this out, and it's out this week because it's fantastic. And it wasn't on my radar at all. And that's now cool. It is.
I mean, you know, I talked about it every time there was a new issue out.
Yeah, but I never listened to you. Whereas I actually really trust Chris's opinion. So
that's cool.
Right. But well, I think you're right about the like sort of fantastical nature of the premise.
Yeah, she's the city's protector, and the city is a, you know, mental asylum.
Right. But then there's also, like, really very self-aware kind of bullshit things that happen to her.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when she saves the, what was it, like, the mayor's daughter or something?
Yes. Uh-huh.
And then the whole time after she saves this girl, she's talking about how, like, terrible Jesse smells, and, like, when was the last time you took a shower, and your hair is so greasy, and, like, it's kind of a bummer thing, because, like, she's homeless. Her street friends are like, hey, it's super cool how you don't have parents. I mean, there's a very bittersweet self-awareness with that kind of crazy superhero vigilante premise.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess your point is that that's the difference between Destiny and Jesse, is that Destiny takes herself and that story takes itself too seriously. Whereas Jesse's story... Street Angel is like a lot more fun,
and it's like because
of the rules,
right? And it's how the it also kind of takes how a, let's say, young teen young teen would perceive the world in some ways. It's the blurring of fantastical and reality,
right?
You know, where you have to like have some self grooming now because you're hitting puberty and. You can't sleep in and, you know, miss school. But at the same time, ninjas are attacking you.
Yeah, ninjas and pirates.
Right. You know, it's that kind of magical, horrible time where you're switching between being a teenager from an adolescent.
Mm.
So there's a lot of that, too. That's, you know, that's kind of the heavy side of the story about a homeless kid, skateboarder who fights.
I guess. Like, I sort of... read Street Angel without most of the heavy stuff at all.
Yeah, me either, but if you start to dig into it, there is that kind of, that's the layer, really, mm-hmm. that it deals with. And that doesn't matter about male or female or anything. I think we all kind of, you know, we all had to go through that time.
Okay, so you think this book would be as successful if Jesse was male?
I mean, yeah, well, what's successful? I don't know how many people are actually reading it.
That's not what I'm using to measure success.
Okay, so you mean successful as in, like, execution?
Yeah, as in, like, the fucking story.
Yeah, I think so.
Man, I just can feel that we're going to argue about this more and more and more moving forward.
Yeah, that's good. I'm looking forward to that.
Huh. I think it's really important.
We have a lot of angst built up, too, over the last couple weeks.
Yeah. There's been a lot of angst.
We need the weekly show to kind of like, it has to come out in, you know, steady amounts. Otherwise, it just is.
If only there was a word for that sort of like release of.
It's a family friendly podcast.
Yeah, got it. Right.
Yeah, I'm just picture like the Hindenburg. Probably. Maybe the subtitle for this episode should be Oh the Humanity.
Oh the Humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly because of you, not because of the comics, right?
Well, are you saying I'm a human?
Because you're a robot.
Okay.
You're a robot.
So then, oh, the humanity because of you.
Because of me. Right.
You see how I tactically turn that back on you?
God, Aaron, you're not a tactical genius. It's super cute that you think you are, but you're not.
You can say it all you want, but we'll see.
We will. I think it's important that Jesse is female because of the same reason that... like time after time after time, she is dismissed by those who don't know what she's capable of. So in this most recent issue, like all the ninjas are fucking scared of her and it's hilarious. And I love those very amusing moments where like she turns to the narrator turns and is like, hey, in the amount of time it took you to go from one panel to the other, Jesse killed all the ninjas. Rah! But the conquistadors don't know, and, like, the devil doesn't know, and, like, completely, like, doubts her capabilities. And but that's really important.
I don't think that has anything to do with her being a female. I think that has
my
her...
Oh, my God.
You can make the same argument of people underestimate a 13-year-old child.
Mm. It is so much more poignant because it's a 13... What? 13? Is that real?
Sure. I mean,
15.
Well, okay. 15, whatever.
A young female teenager. Like, a couple years younger than Destiny. Destiny's 17. I would say Jessie is, like, 15.
I think... You're right. There is an enhancement.
I'm sorry, what? What did you say?
Well, hang on. Because you can't... I'm saying you're right that there is an enhancement in our minds because we have a predisposition to dismiss females as not having the same capabilities as males. But we also have a pretty big predisposition to dismiss non-peers as having the same capability or experience as us.
Explain.
So we, being old people in our mid-30s, mm-hmm. will look at people younger than us as not being, you know, as worldly, as experienced, as knowledgeable as we are in our ripe old age.
Okay.
So to me, a 15-year-old, female or male, is a dumb kid who, you know, isn't really capable of doing much besides rolling out of bed at noon.
But that's the premise of, like, so many books right now. Like, look at Deadly Class, and, like, look at... Even Sam Alexander has kind of come into his own.
Right, but that's a male character. It's not... I don't think being a female would make it any different.
It totally makes it different. That's my whole point. Mm-hmm. Is that the like, judgment is so much greater with the female characters.
I think you're projecting.
Okay. I don't think I am. But obviously my perspective is...
You've already admitted at the very beginning of the show that you are off your game. And therefore, I'm correct in my argument. And I win the show this week.
Oh, man. You know, that kind of makes me wish that Cameron was still scoring our shows. Because I feel like he would be on my side this week.
See, again, you're wrong. This is, you know, hopefully next week you're back at it, but wow. You were just really off this week.
Oh, mansplaining, Aaron. I missed you.
You know where you were on, though?
Where?
You were on with our interview.
Yeah, I was.
Which we are really about to do right now.
We did it on Sunday. We talked to Ulysses Farinas. And we're going to play it for you now.
Wait, let me get it in the tape deck here. Hang on.
Yep.
All right. And
did you have to take, like, awesome mix number one out?
Yes. All right, well, let's let people listen to our awesome interview.
Fantastic.
Wonderful.
Hi, Aaron. Hi, Andrea. Jason Sachs here at Jason Sachs on the Twitter. Buy my book, The American Comic Book Chronicles of the 1970s, published by Tomorrow's Press. Out first week in September, it seems. Thanks, you guys, for the private comics therapy this week. You guys, if you go to a con with Andrea, make sure to ask her about the Freudian issues and the heroes that you love, because Andrea can dig deep, find truth. All right, I'm telling a little bit of a story, but Andrea's pretty good about the therapy thing. Anyway, I live in Seattle. Got a lot of really great comic shops here. Really for no reason other than that it is close to my work. I like to shop at Arcane Comics, which is in the Seattle neighborhood of Ballard. It's a great store. Very friendly people, great sales clerks. The owner is a... All right, Andrea, you're going to laugh. The owner is a drinking buddy of mine. Shocking, I know. But they also they have just an amazing selection of comics. Big back room about graphic novels, original art. They host signing and autograph sessions and draw-offs, and they're open every night Tuesday night at midnight for drinking and comics, which is always a win, major win. And the guys from Fantagraphic shop there, and, you know, it's just a great comic shop. I mean, I miss the days in a weird way of those seedy, old, cheesy comic shops that were kind of these in the rundown areas of town where you could wander in. They were never clean and you could find anything you wanted. But I'll take the nice shops these days. So anyway, there's my call. Sorry I'm a little rambly today, but, you know, still close to Comic-Con buzz. Hope you're still feeling it too, Andrea. And we missed you, Aaron. Talk to you guys soon. Bye.
This week on The Couch, we welcome artist and writer Ulysses Farinas. Ulysses drew the Agents of Change stories in the Catalyst Comics reboot published by Dark Horse and just wrapped up the Judge Dredd Mega City 2 miniseries published by IDW. He's teaming up again with his Agents of Change collaborator Joe Casey for the Captain Victory series published by Dynamite Comics, the first issue of which came out this week. He's co-writing and doing the covers for the anthology series Amazing Forest, published digitally by Monkey Brain Comics, and he's the artist and co-writer of Gamma, a one-shot serialized in Dark Horse Presents. Thanks for talking with us today, Ulysses.
Hey.
Well, before we get into the fun stuff,
This is still fun.
Is this still fun?
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Then this is fun stuff too. Let's get into it. Tell us a little bit about Captain Victory. It's a collaborative project with a number of artists, right?
Yeah.
And anything else that you want to talk about too, like anything else we should be looking for the rest of 2014, 2015?
Right now for Captain Victory, I'm waiting to read it myself. I haven't had a chance to read the whole thing. Amazing Forest, still writing. I don't do all the covers on that. I actually only did one of the covers, and it's just a big mega project with all like the many artists I like, and writing with Eric Freitas again, which we did for Gamma.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And hopefully we'll be doing for Gamma 2 if that happens.
Is that a matter of, if Gamma 2 happens, is it a matter of people sending enough toys to you as bribes in order to do it?
Pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
Well, like, I'm going to draw it either way. So if someone's just like, hey, if you do a panel for this, you know, stuffed shark toy, which is what I'm looking forward to as my next one. if someone says that, then, you know, I'm going to do it. So they totally get the process going. And hopefully it'll see that Dark Horse has, you know, there's people interested enough to
send me
toys, you know.
So I assume with each toy you get, you're going to send a picture to your editors at Dark Horse and say, like,
yeah,
look, people are sending me toys. They want more of this.
Exactly. So hopefully Gamma is going to go forward in the future. Who knows in what form, hopefully in every form.
Toy especially.
Yeah, seriously. If I can make the complete circle and get toys of my own toys sent to me to draw more, I'll just enter like a black hole of just creativity.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
But,
so you haven't read anything from Captain Victory yet?
Just like the art that was sent to me to kind of, because it's a, you know, it's a collaborative project, so I had to like match it with,
right,
like, you know, Nathan Fox's work. So I haven't read the whole finished book, you know, finished issue from start to front. So I have to go out there, and usually it's easier for me to just go buy the comic than to wait for the comics to get to me.
Got it.
Well, that sounds like a decent amount on your plate still.
Oh, yeah, I keep my plate full, like Thanksgiving.
Uh-huh. Wonderful.
Anything else that is a little bit longer term that you haven't started working on that you can still talk about?
I guess I can start talking about, I'm doing a book with Oni in like probably 2015 or so called Motro, which is a book I started working on when I was 20. And now I'm doing another version of it. And I kind of predict I'll probably be doing a version of this comic my entire life, just because you'll never get perfect with it.
Hmm.
So I'm working on that and working on a few web comics, which will be like kind of one panel a week comics with a bunch of different artists. And I'm always doing little things. You know, you never know what's going to come up.
So is Motro for Oni, is that something that you're writing and drawing?
Uh-huh.
Okay. And that's just you? That's like a one-man show?
Well, it's always, I always work with Eric Freitas as my co-writer.
Got it.
Just because I'm not so strong of a writer from getting to point A from to point B. So me and Eric have been working together since we're like 11 years old. So we kind of are yin to our yang.
Yeah. Is he in Portland with you?
He's in Jersey.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I grew up in Jersey. I've only been in Portland for like the last year or so.
Like everybody else in comics, it's fine.
Yeah, pretty much.
Made the exodus.
So you started, but you didn't finish art school, right? And you've talked before about that sort of disconnect between like going to school for comics and then like actually making them. So I'm curious if you have mentors within the industry, like, because you didn't do the school thing, which is totally fine. Do you have artists or writers that you've connected with for more of an informal support system? Like, you've got Eric, and that's great, but he's a collaborator. Are there other people that you've turned to, like, in more of a mentor relationship?
I don't know if mentor is really the correct word. I'm not sure if my personality really allows for mentors. Just it's really hard for me to to look up to anyone besides, like, my father or my mother. Beyond, I would think of a lot of my peers, if it is a support network, it's more like brothers. It's like we're doing similar things, going in different directions, and no one's really above anyone else. I haven't really had, I guess when it comes to, like, older guys who would be mentors, I don't really have much of a connection to, I guess, the comics art form in that way of thinking of, like, I think all of comics is way too young to be even having mentors at this point.
So I guess then if it's somebody who you would consider a peer, what if they have more, gosh, I don't know. I was going to say if they have been in the industry longer, but that doesn't necessarily mean, that's not an indicator of success necessarily. Maybe let's look at it this way. Do you like seek out your fellow, like you're in Portland, right? Do you seek out fellow comics creators and like collaborate informally or just sort of talk about making comics? Was that one of the reasons why you went to Portland in the first place?
Well, I went to Portland just because I wanted to move out of New York, just because I only grew up in New Jersey and New York.
Right.
My entire life. And if I was going to move anywhere, it'd have to be somewhere that wouldn't slow me down in terms of, like, Portland has such a big comic scene, and it's probably, like, the only scene right now as far as comics go that's growing and, you know, growing at the same rate that New York City would be. Whereas, you know, New York City is, like, the capital of the world. As far as comics go, there's, like, what, L.A., New York, there's Vermont, and there's a few other cities in, like, the United States and Northern America that have a very strong comic community, and Portland, I would say, is number two to New York, number one.
Right. So what do you get out of being in Portland, then?
Nothing. I'm a very solitary, like, artist. I like that I live by myself now. in terms of, like, seeking out people to work with or to have as, like, mentors,
you can throw the mentor word out. I'm mostly curious if you, like, get out of your apartment and talk to other people ever.
Yeah, sometimes. But I'm not sure if it informs my work in any significant way. I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
I guess my question then would be, how do you, you know, everyone has a growth or a change as time goes on. Like, what's the biggest catalyst then for your growth or your change in work, as you know, over the years, or have you, or is there?
I guess I think competition. A lot of times it's competition. There's that, I watched that movie, There'll Be Blood, and there's always that famous scene where he's like, you know, I have a competition in me. I want no one else to succeed. And to a certain extent, you have to feel that way a lot of times. Is just kind of, how do I push myself that much harder than the hypothetical other artist who's going to get my job? And I think that's kind of how I approach a lot of my projects. It's like, okay, I'm doing this. I just finished a Godzilla commission for just, you know, shits and giggles for a friend. And in my head, I was like, well, let me see if I can make this, like, into my top five favorite drawings for myself. Let me see if I can just do that. Because most of the time, you just kind of spin your wheels and no one's ever going to notice.
So does that mean you're competing against yourself? Like, you're talking about hypothetical competition. You're not talking about a direct competitor with a job. Is it like a game that you play with yourself? I don't mean that in a bad way. Just like, are you sort of intentionally psyching yourself out that way because you know it works for you?
Yeah. Well, I think you have to be able, like, it's useful to have a certain amount of, like, hate against yourself, you know, mm-hmm. of being angry with yourself, being angry with what your life is like, and always using that to try to be better. There's a certain amount of, like, bravado that's just kind of manufactured, that just kind of keeps you thinking, how do I measure up to this?
Gotcha.
Well, you're clearly a storyteller at heart, from the detail in your drawings to your own written work to even, you know, let's say, some of the antics you pull online, which we can talk about that later. But, you know, what's the through line for you? When do you sit down to draw someone else's script versus write your own? Is there a common approach to your personal work versus the work for hire, you know, working on someone else's script?
I think a lot of times there's a myth that if you're doing creator-owned work, that's somehow more personal, that's somehow more fulfilling, that's somehow more of a truer example of this artist. And I think if you're waiting a lot of times for to write your own story and you're not putting that yourself into even your work for hire stuff, the stuff that a lot of, I guess, people who, you know, talk about comics kind of dismiss as, oh, yeah, you know, who cares about Judge Dredd? You know, it's just a character that how many other people have written on. Then you're doing yourself a disservice. A lot of time, I don't see a distinction between when someone's paying me for a page rate versus when I'm sitting down and making my own story. To me, it's how do I put myself into this in the best way possible? Hmm.
Is that true when you are writing as well as drawing?
Yeah, definitely. I find no satisfactory difference between, say, writing, you know, any potential, like if I was going to write Star Trek or if I was going to write Spider-Man or if I was going to write Gamma. There's no difference to me. It's like, how do I make this my own?
And it seems like a lot of creators take that approach, except when it comes to, say, like a Judge Dredd, there's still guidelines within those characters, right? That you have to, you can't slap a Judge Dredd label on it and totally, I guess, redo, you know, the character. You still have confines within those creations versus some new, you know, story that you made yourself.
But you have those confines even with the stories you make yourself. You can't, you know, if you've been... Imagine, like, say, Eric Larson's Savage Dragon. He has, like, Michelle Fife did a little anthology project a few years back that I worked on, and one of the things that you couldn't draw Savage Dragon with his fin not going, flat out from his forehead. Mm-hmm. That was, like, the edicts. And it's like you end up having those same guidelines. As when you're writing any character, the character has to kind of write itself. You have to know what will this person and do and not do, in the same way as if you're writing Judge Dredd. Like, what will Judge Dredd do and not do? It's the same thing as, will Dusty and Gamma ever stop being, like, a pervert? No, he always has to. The core of his character means he has to always come back to doing something fucked up just to get laid. You know, that is, and you are restricted to that. And eventually, maybe you don't want to tell that story anymore and you give it to someone else.
Okay.
But it's just a matter of who set up those parameters.
Yeah. But you
they still exist.
Yeah, you're still bound to them.
Yeah. What about, like, shorter form stuff? Like, I guess is there an appeal then to doing something more in a, like, one-shot format? If it's something that then you can, not necessarily that you're tired of telling that story, but then you can just move on to a new story and not have to be as invested in maintaining those parameters?
I've only done shorter work so far, and the book I'm doing for Oni is going to be a much larger book, and that's kind of stretching my I guess creative abilities in a new way, just because, you know, I haven't worked on a book that's been longer than, like, maybe six issues.
Yeah.
But I kind of like that. I grew up reading short stories, and all of Amazing Forest is short stories. They're all 8 pages, which are ultra short. But ultimately, I kind of feel the length of the book is irrelevant. You know, it's what deserves to be that long. You know, you can't stretch every story to be, you know, a graphic novel, and not every graphic novel can be condensed into 8 pages.
Right. So we talk a lot about work-life balance. Like, Aaron and I talk about that in our own lives, and then it always comes up with the various creators that we talk to. And you've written on your own site about getting behind on deadlines and the kind of personal stress of that situation, balancing like this desire to constantly improve in your craft, but with the very finite allowance of time. Do you have a system in place now to sort of catch yourself? Is it just about having greater self-discipline, or is it something else?
I don't really have any work-life balance.
That's a problem.
Well, no, I don't think it's a deliberate problem. And I think a lot of times for growing, like, new artists or artists who, you know, and I'm still a new artist, so, you know, I'm kind of talking out of my ass here. But when it comes to approaching, like, something that is almost completely rewardless, you don't really get too much out of drawing comics. If you're not willing to kind of destroy your work-life balance, I often find it hard to respect an artist who's just like, well, I still want to have fun. I still want to go out. It's like, well, okay, if you want your career to take 15 years longer, you know. I got out of college when I was like 20, 21, and I had to get into comics by the time I was 25, and I did it. But I don't have any friends, and I don't really have a very I don't always have the friendliest disposition, you know, and that's okay, because, you know, to become an expert at something, you kind of have to give up the things that aren't really necessary, and the first thing that you can give up is people.
When did you make that decision? Like, when, you know, because that's a very deliberate, like, life plan, in a way, it sounds like. So, who did somebody instill that in you, that, you know, the focus on work and for the sacrifice of play for, you know, for a long-term goal? Because most people don't either never learn it or don't learn, you know, to kind of to put aside instant gratification for a long-term reward.
I think I remember as a kid, I wasn't allowed to really have friends, where my father would be like, oh, you don't need to have friends, we have a big family. So I stayed home. And I also could draw no matter what punishment I had. So if I was sent to my room, I could still draw. If I didn't get my homework done, I could still draw. There was never a time where my parents took away that gratification. So no matter what happened, I always had the I can work. And there was always a very strong immigrant kind of disposition in my household. You know, my family comes from a very poor working class background, and play was something that was a luxury, was a privilege. And when you saw other people playing all day, my father, but also my mother and even my brothers, there was almost a certain kind of looking down upon people like that, like, oh, they're lazy, they deserve what they get. So when you have that kind of like automatic disgust almost towards people who aren't working hard enough, it's impossible for you to be like, if someone's begging you to leave the house to go hang out, for you to get past that innate disgust at yourself. You're just like, no, it really can't. I can't, you know?
Hmm. Do you wish sometimes you could, you know, is there comfort in that denial now? Like, is that a comfort zone of the buckling down, or is it sort of mixed with sort of, self-loathing or
I guess a lot of times, if, you know, I feel depressed a lot of times, and if the number one feeling I have is I wish this wasn't my life. And I wish I had a different life. You know, I feel, you know, people talk about depression, you know, they'll talk about it very often, like a medical kind of standpoint, like, oh, you know, it's not their fault. This is just like, you know, the brain chemistry. But a lot of times they don't talk about, like, you know, I really don't like my life. I really don't like it a lot of times. I feel like I wish I had been born into, I guess, a more privileged household. I wish I had the choice to go out and have friends. I wish I was nicer a lot of times. Mm. But at the end of the day, there's no room for moping.
Does that kind of help stave off some of that depression too?
It makes it capable to continue working even when you're depressed.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like this kind of not really a crutch, but like it's equivalent to drinking to numb the pain. You know, it's just like, oh, well, I can still do comics even when I'm crying. I can still do it, and it puts it off for a little bit. Mm-hmm. And it maybe not be the best psychological thing, but you know.
Do you think about how that's probably not a sustainable way of doing comics, though? Like, it's working right now for you, but, like, in a long-term way, that... Because you're right. It doesn't sound super healthy. At a certain point, like, maybe you would need to have a balance with something else that makes you happy, like, that you can really say, yeah. Today was a really good day, and I'm really happy with this. Do you think that will come from comics?
I guess it comes from moving to a higher tax bracket.
Okay.
Like,
I get that.
There's definitely a feeling, and it also is true because a lot of times I think, you know, just keep working, it'll get better, you'll get a break, keep work, but then you get the break and you fill it with work and you keep working. But I have found that I am less depressed than I was when I was younger. I am able to see certain rewards from my work. And even like, it's not always doom and gloom when it comes to our friendships. I do meet, like this past San Diego Comic-Con, I did meet a lot of people where I was just like, ah, okay, this is someone I can roll with, you know? And it's like, I'm not sure if it's sustainable or not. I just know that, you know, my parents went through so much worse than I did. And they're not perfect people, but I think they're good people at the end of the day. You know, so if I could only end up as half as good as my parents, then I guess I'll be okay.
So what's the drive though? If there's a long term goal, you know, depression or not, you say these sacrifices and this sort of mode, you know, has an end point or has like milestones to reach that you've put off for, you know, for the immediate gratification. Like, what would feel comfortable to you?
At the end of my life?
Well, I don't know. Is that the end? Is like,
No. Pick something sooner than that.
Right. Like, is there
something
by the
that
age
you can
of
celebrate?
Well, you know, say you got into comics. You got into comics by 25 because you applied yourself. So at 35, is there a milestone to reach? At, you know, 45, is there a milestone to reach? Like, is there in your mind a point where you say, if I reach this point, then I relax a little bit, then I, you know, then I feel like I've made it to a certain level?
I wrote once before about like, what's the ultimate goal? Like, what? And a lot of times, like, the reason I feel like so, I get, you know, kind of stuck with a certain kind of lifestyle is because I feel like I have a debt to pay back to, you know, my parents. That, you know, they went through something, so I can only do the bare minimum and deal with this. And I think my ultimate goal is often an end of the life goal. And it's just for, if I do have kids, that they won't have a debt to pay back to me, that they'll be taken care of.
Mm.
And the only way I feel like I can reach that goal is by excellence. And I might not end up being the best artist. And, you know, there's no way of even figuring out what that means, but
right.
Being really the best of what you can do. And, you know, a lot of times people think, oh, well, this is really good, this is my best work ever. And it's like, no, you'll never know what your best work is. You'll, you know, hopefully when I'm an old man, if I have kids, they'll be like, they won't be having to fight some corporation for the rights to my book.
Mm-hmm.
And get paid.
Hmm. So it's more the cautionary tales of the past and getting past that and getting to a place where maybe you had to struggle your life, but your children or, you know, and your children's children don't.
Exactly.
And is that seems like a pretty common, that's not an uncommon kind of mentality, especially for children of first or second generation.
Mm-hmm.
Because I mean, it's the American dream where, I mean, it's the same, like my family's history is the same. You come to this country and if you work hard and you sacrifice, anything's possible. It might not be possible for you, but you know, those who come after you, you know, they'll be the successful ones. So I guess then my question is, you know, why comics?
I don't know. You know, sometimes I think about that. Like the simple answer a lot of times I give people is because I'm good at it.
Mm-hmm.
But then I think, well, why am I good at it? And the more accurate question is, why storytelling?
Yeah.
Why tell a story? Why sit there and make something up? Because I really don't care about comics. Whether I make a story that's a comic or I'll make a story that's a, you know, I start writing some Riddick versus Judge Dredd fan fiction or, you know, or if it's a movie. I don't really care how the story comes out as long as it comes out. And so why storytelling? And there, you know, I recently just did a review for the Guardians of the Galaxy movie that's amazing. And it's a refuge. It's like when you need to believe in these fictional things so that these really hard to grasp real things become smaller that you can handle them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of how I approach a lot of fiction. It's like, how do I deal with these kind of larger, difficult concepts? You know, like all of the stories I write are kind of are exploring concepts. Usually they're exploring things that I hate about myself, like, you know, being a dude, like being a pervert, like being a son of an immigrant, things that are just like, how do these things bother me? But how do I handle it? And you make it smaller by making it larger than life.
Hmm. Is that a way of kind of mastering our fears and mm-hmm. the things we don't like about it, is blowing them up to the impossible?
I think so. I think that's why story is a universal human experience. There's not one person on this planet that doesn't tell stories, that doesn't like hearing stories. It's, you know, people are like, oh, we waste your time all day watching TV. It's just like, no, this is what makes the time worthwhile, is hearing stories from other people, because it's the truest language. It's the one thing that gives you the human experience, that you can hear a story from 2,000 years ago. You know, Beowulf was spoken word and then written down. But it still is relevant to today. Hmm. And no matter what person in human history can make a story, and that story is truly immortal.
Is there something inherent about the collaborative nature of comics that is appealing to you? I guess as opposed to just writing stories or just telling them on your own, is there a comfort in telling your story with somebody else, either your writing partner or illustrating stories that somebody else wrote? Is the other people part important to you?
No. I guess with me and Eric, we're very seamless. So we don't know where to take, like, who wrote what, who came mm-hmm. up with what, to the extent that, you know, we'll be, you know, talking, pitching comics to an editor or whatever, and we'll just pull from each other's like hat of like what ideas they were working on or what idea Eric was working on, and I'll be like, oh, check out this idea, and I'll throw it out there like I came up with it, but it doesn't make a difference, because at the end of the day, we've almost created like a headspace that doesn't have ownership in it.
But that's very specific to your relationship with Eric. That is probably not. Something that translates to any other collaborators.
Yeah, that's very unique, and I'm grateful for that one. Otherwise, collaboration for me is comics. I've chosen comics to be more specific, is because it doesn't need to have such a large team, and I could work fairly independently.
Mm, okay. As opposed to like screenwriting or something else that is. Yeah.
You know, you write a screenplay and someone's going to change it, or you're going to make a movie and you have to work with a director. You know,
right.
It's more work.
Did you read comics as a kid? Is it something that you had exposure to later in life? Like what, you know, you're saying at 21, you kind of made that decision to, and then by 25, you got into comics. But what about as a reader? What about as a fan of literature or stories? Were comics part of that growing up?
Not too much. Mm-hmm. Like I liked comics like in passing, but we were too poor to really afford them.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I was one of the main comic I read the most of, and just by complete accident, was when my dad brought home an entire crate of Archie comics.
Uh-huh.
So I read a lot of those, but I remember being really fascinated with like the texture of the paper and the advertisements and just the art. And I remember I would buy all like the, you know, like when the Liefeld era kind of, you know, like the big guns and, you know, X-Force and Iron Man foil cover.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked them as artifacts almost. Not mm-hmm. so much. It was an Iron Man number 300 book or something that I never actually read the story. I would just kept looking through all the different Iron Man suits. And I mostly grew up reading children's books and encyclopedias. And that's actually closer to my approach to writing, is often, you know, creating these worlds and creating these cutie little characters.
But it's partly... You know, it sounds like, at least from your description of what you attracted you to those 90s books, too, was the, and the Archies, is the production and the, I guess, you know, the graphic design, that sort of thing?
Yeah, yeah. That was much more like what these books look like, what, you know, these collection of costumes. I would buy the Marvel trading cards like crazy. I had a whole, you know, baseball deck, you know, just all the different Marvel superheroes, because I love to see their strength ratings. I love to see the different costumes as they change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Thing randomly had a shield face for like 1 year. And I didn't know why as a kid, because I didn't read the comic. I just was like, okay, he gets a shield face. And there was only like an illusion. It said like Wolverine slashed his face in issue something. And I never read the comic. I was like, man, this Wolverine guy is the best. Why would you slice all Thing's face? He's not that bad. He's a nice guy. So you know, I was always exposed to comics. I always had a comics vocabulary, but it wasn't from I knew this writer or I knew this artist. I didn't know who Rob Liefeld was until I was in like college. I didn't know who Jim Lee was until I was like 17 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So. It was only then, and I was like, oh, man. And still to this day, people bring up an artist. I'm like, wait, who? And it's like, how do you not know who that is? And I was like, because it's not really important to me.
Hmm. How does that, with that kind of perspective growing up, how do you ever think about now modern readers and how there is, at least, you know, if it's online community, there's very much attention now to the creators behind projects, which I don't think widespread became apparent, or even I think was even part of the culture until the internet, where you could kind of have that sort of encyclopedia. You know, you had to be really the guy who sat down with the, you know, the indexes to find out, you know, this person wrote these things. You know, it just wasn't accessible. You couldn't just type it in and look it up, you know, prior to the late 90s. But I still know people that follow, you know, creations and not creators. And in terms of your own work and thinking about that, does it matter that somebody picks up one of your books and knows who you are?
No, it doesn't matter. I think someone asked me if my parents have read my comics, and I said no, they don't read my comics. They're like, does that bother you? You know, I'm just like, no, because they only care that I'm doing what I love. You know, they don't care, like, it's never been important for me to be like, you know, there's always the cliche of a kid showing his parents a drawing. And it's like, oh, is that a cat? And they're like, no, it's this thing. And it's like, I never had that interaction with my parents. They're just like, nice drawing. It didn't matter what it was.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, when you're younger and you know, part of the reason I don't have a good large breadth of knowledge when it comes to comics because I was unable to because I couldn't afford it. But it also makes you appreciate the art that you did have in your life that much more because I pored over children's books over and over and over again. I would read them over and over and over again and really kind of try to understand, like, why do I love this? Why is it so, like, perfect to me? And when it comes to, like, following creators now, I think there's a lot of this kind of false idolatry where we're unable to actually truly appreciate when they do something well and unable to understand when they make mistakes. So they make, you know, sometimes you'll see comics that come out and they're truly not the best showing. It's really kind of some shitty work out there. But because you have this idea like, oh, Grant Morrison is a great writer, you're unable to actually understand why he's a great writer. You're just accepting everything like Jesus.
Well, is it also that there's pressure to praise those who have made it to that tier of greatness?
Oh yeah.
You know, well, regardless of
well,
how,
there's
of
pressure
how the
work to praise,
is.
But there's also a lack of understanding about how to talk about the medium. So there's like a bunch of things going on here that, like, I completely agree with you that we put anybody who's reached that level of household nameness, for lack of a better way to describe it, everybody who's reached that level is sort of golden. But yeah, then we can't actually talk about it critically at any point. And well, when I say we, I mean all of us. Like, there are very few people who really have the understanding of the medium and the vocabulary to discuss, like, what it is about storytelling in a serial form like comics, like, actually consists of.
Well, I think that there's, like, an arms race for cultural knowledge a lot of times. Anytime you say you like something, someone's just like, well, have you read this? Mm-hmm. Or if you say you don't like something, it's like, well, you don't like it because you just don't know because you haven't read this. And right, there's this kind of, like, one-upsmanship of you don't know, or I'm the one who has the vocabulary to talk about comics. I'm the one who is the critical voice. And you're just kind of like, well, you know, comics have only been around for, like, the last 100 years, so we're talking about something that we can't step out of.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a lot of the times when, you know, I read about, like, you know, like, people talk about, oh, they need good comics, but then people are saying, oh, well, we need good criticism, and no one's really understanding that none of us are really capable of doing that because we're so steeped in it.
Right.
When there's so many critics that are also creators, and they're not good creators, or there's so many creators that are just terrible critics and they're not good critics, no one's having a conversation that phenomenon only happens because there's no one removed from it.
Mm-hmm. It's so insular that it's actually doing
exactly
us all a disservice.
You know, there's a lot of, you know, creators that just spend all day striving to be a voice in comics, and they only end up kind of just circle jerking themselves into, like, an intellectual fervor. Whereas mm-hmm. it's like, oh, this doesn't even deserve this amount of attention.
Well,
and it's
no,
unfortunate.
Go ahead. Because I want to push you in a slightly different direction, but all very much related. Because you're a little bit known for this in some circles. Like, you definitely have a reputation for calling people on their shit. And it's refreshing. But on the other hand, like, there's a line there in a very small collaborative industry like comics where you can alienate the people that you want to work with. And I'm curious if it's ever bitten you in the ass, or if you're worried that it will.
Well, I always say that there's nothing I've said that can make a person lose their job. And there's nothing I say has any consequences. And it's strange. You want to speak with authority. And if you speak with authority, it means you have a certain amount of power. And if you have a certain amount of power, it means you have power over other people that you can affect their lives. And I'm saying that I don't have any power, that everything I'm saying is bullshit. Don't listen to me. It doesn't affect your life. You can turn me off. You can turn off the podcast. You can X out the page. Nothing means anything. And until we actually have a more formal way of looking at our work, where some people truly decide to step out of being creators and, like, look, okay, I'm just going to be a critic. When we have a more mature understanding of what we want from our medium, then people will have authority. But up till then, a guy talking on the, I'm no more different than any other fan on the internet talking shit. And I think there's so much of a focus of like, oh, is this going to have any consequences on your career? And just like, well, part of me wants to be like, worry about yourself. But two, it's just like, did I really say anything that was so hurtful that it's more hurtful that you don't like what my drawings look like anymore? And that's, I think, an unfair approach.
Mm-hmm. Does that go back to the, you know, the glad handing that goes on, that it's almost once somebody kind of just says something outside of that, you know, that baseline of niceness, you know, that it automatically gets elevated to, well, you know, you said they should die and their family should be set on fire. You know, that there's not much critical reading when it comes to somebody's opinion if it's not completely positive.
Well, you know, I grew up listening to like hip hop music, and there's so much mythology in hip hop music that they talk about money, they talk about bling, they talk about killing people, and you know that this guy is showing up like at the Nickelodeon Music Awards or something, and you know he also said that he killed someone. It was like, as a kid, you really quickly understand he's making it up. It doesn't make his songs less powerful. It doesn't make the lyrics less transgressive, but Ice-T plays a cop and made this one of the most famous songs that was called Cop Killer.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
I find it almost hilarious that these creators and critics and stuff who are in a medium that mostly is all about fiction, of writing people in spandex that can fly, or, you know, how many different, you know, not to just say superhero comics, but in general, like fictionalized biographies where your cat can talk and we just accept it. That we accept all these other ways of fiction, but when a guy just talks a little louder, they're like, oh my God, you're so offensive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, come on, get real. It's just like, understand when you can see someone who's just talking a little bit with a little bit of bluster, and when he's not actually going to go to your house and punch you in the face. You know,
right.
Like, I'm never going to do that. I'm not going to go up to any creator and piss on their comics. But I'll say, man, someone should piss on this guy's comics. it's just like, come on. That's an easy concept to grasp.
Do you think that's also, that comics is still, this gets into weird territories of like cultural voices within comics too. You know, when you're talking about like hip hop culture, I think there are racial connotations to that, even though hip hop in itself is not defined by a race.
Yeah.
There's still racial associations with it. That you could have, say, Cop Killer, or, you know, you have when you're talking about the Dozens or something like that, where there's a culture behind it that doesn't exist within comics though. Yeah. You know, that there's not a translation there.
You don't think that there is not like an inherent white male culture influencing comics for the last 100 years?
I would say that's true for comics. I don't know if that's not really true for hip hop, but I think it would still be minority driven, art form.
I'm just trying to understand what your comparison is.
Well, that within the culture of hip hop, that sort of negative, you know, that sort of, taking apart or taking down and kind of the fight culture within it that then, you're expected to stand up or defend doesn't exist within comics, you know, as a different art form.
Gotcha. Because comics is a product of the like majority culture.
Sure. I guess so. Is that,
yeah.
But is that,
yep, that's it right there. That's it.
But is that where the translation then fails, that we are, because the majority culture has such an aversion to that confrontational?
I would say it's a majority culture. I would say it's definitely a white male culture, or not even white male. I would say it's a suburban culture.
Right.
Where there is something, you know, like you just mentioned, like the Dozens. I grew up and there was always you could get in a fight with a dude because he was insulting you. And you could also have the same a good time with a dude because he's insulting you. And there's somewhere in there a magical line of what you don't cross.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I one of the first angry reviews I did, and everyone got in a fuss, was I was talking about Yale Stewart, and I said he needed to grow a pair of balls and actually stick to writing his own comic. Because on his bio page, he says, I'm working on this comic, and I also do JL8. And you look at the comic he puts first, and he hasn't worked on it since, 3 years now. And I was just saying, putting it out there, just work on it. You say you're working on it, put your balls on the line, just do it. And the response, I forget what the guy's name, something like Justin Jordan or one of those guys, very quickly messaged me, fuck you, you're so edgy. Mm-hmm. And that was crossing the line. That was just like, no, I'm not saying fuck you to anyone.
Hmm.
Me was a request to put your money where your mouth is, and in a kind of, it seems insulting, but I'm not insulting you. And his was, I deliberately don't like you.
Because it was lost in translation, though?
Yeah, and I think that's what it was. It's like he is unable to see that when I say, hey, grow a pair of balls and draw your own comic, it's really no commentary on even if he has balls. He could be a woman for all I care. But you say fuck you to a person, that's the pointed insult. Mm. It's just like, no, I just don't like you. Mm. There's no commentary there.
But say somebody like, if it was Justin Jordan, like he doesn't have the lexicon to understand what you're saying. And is it a fault of cultural disconnection, or is it a fault of the medium that the discourse takes place in? Because Twitter's pretty bad, I think, for kind of parsing out complex, sort of ideas.
Well, I think it's not just in comics, but throughout the internet, is that there are a million different cultures crashing up against each other, and no one knows that they're in a different culture.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's guys who are coming at it from, I love comics, but I'm a screenwriter. And then there's guys who are coming at it like, I love storytelling, and I don't care what the medium is. Then there's guys coming at it as like comics at all costs. Then there's people who are coming at it like, oh, I'm a feminist first, and I want to see comics be more feminist. Then there's guys who are complete sexist, and they just want sexism throughout anything they like.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't
matter. They really don't have an allegiance to Captain America or any character. They just want it to reinforce their bigoted beliefs.
And I'd say there's even another tier of people. It's just a paycheck.
Exactly. The thing is, there's millions of these miniature communities using words that sound the same but mean something completely different within that community.
Hmm.
And when someone who grows up listening to hip hop reads my reviews, and I've had this basically anyone who I hang out with at a convention, if they know anything about hip hop, they look at me and they laugh like, yeah, I know what you're doing. You're being an asshole.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll talk to someone else, I don't really see, I see what you're doing, but I really don't agree with it. And it's like, no, you don't see what I'm doing. You're just agreeing to be polite. And the whole polite thing is where you're messed up. But that whole, it's difficult. I want to maintain the way I talk, but I also want to reach different people. And there's always that, do I neuter this? Do I translate this into the mass speak, the suburban speak, the white male speak,
mm-hmm.
or do I actually focus on who likes my work? A Spanish guy, a ghetto guy, a Jersey guy, a dumb guy, a bro, that's who I'm who I would focus on, but it's not going to get me a larger audience.
It almost makes me wonder, when you do a review or you make a statement, you do two versions and you put them side by side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A lot of times I've thought of that, it's like I'll write something and then I'll edit it. And I'm like, you know what? This took out all my flavor,
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, that's my little sofrito, the particular flavoring that makes me. And I took it out just so I'd be sound more agreeable.
Hmm. And maybe we lose a lot of voices, especially in creative mediums, because there's a need to homogenize, that discourse. And I guess it then gets translated down to the art as well.
Okay.
I don't think it's a need. I think it's a choice. And I think that what Ulysses just said is very apt. It's a choice to reach a wider audience. And there's nothing wrong with that choice.
But it is
a choice.
But you say wider audience, and it also sounds like you're saying whiter audience. And that's actually... No, but
it's very true.
that's what ends up being a lot of times. Is the wider audience is often only interpreted as a whiter audience, even though that's fundamentally not true and becoming more untrue every day.
Mm-hmm. But is having the bridge discourse, you know, it's the baby steps that you can't push someone into the pool. You know, you can't say, well, you just got to dive in the deep end. Or can you? Is there a disservice in changing your art, your expression, your thought to accommodate someone else's lack of skills to understand it?
No, I think accommodation is a lot of times the first step towards defeat. And I think I try to be less angry just publicly, because I found that it just kind of reinforces itself, that you just get angrier and angrier.
Mm-hmm.
The more anytime I rage out, there's always the deliberate decision of how long am I going to keep raging about this? Do I keep commenting? Do I keep disagreeing with someone? Now I just delete stuff and move on, or I won't post it at all, or I'll just delete the whole thread. I'm just like, okay, I had my fun. I'm done. There's this idea where it's just like I don't want to have to explain what I'm doing every single time, because it's like explaining the joke. But at the same time, you do need to give people sometimes a refresher course of like, okay, guys, remember, this is not real.
Well, I think of myself as replying then to say, like, I've seen some of your posts where it's like, if I think I understand where you're coming from on it, it's because it's your voice, but it's not my voice, you know? Yeah. So if I respond in an attempt in the same way, it's going to come off false, because it's trying to mimic, you know, something that I'm not accustomed to.
Yeah. I've been really frustrated a lot of times where people are like, well, I agree with you, I just don't like the way you said it. And I'm just like, that is the most nitpicky. Oh, like, well, if you wanted it to sound differently, then you can write that, you know, like, such a strange thing to be like, I don't like your voice. Hmm. And it's just like, well, I don't like yours either. Now I'm going to delete that comment, you know, like.
Yeah. Yeah. It's something for me to think about, because it comes back to how do you have discourse across different, you know, cultural divides, basically,
mm-hmm.
without having to meet in a very kind of, I don't know, uninteresting sort of, you know, middle valley.
Often the group in power is the one that determines what is the valid way of having discourse, and anything different from that is offensive.
Hmm.
And so a lot of times it is that decision. Do I compromise and feel like I just got defeated, or do I compromise because they actually want to listen?
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Yeah, that's sorry, I'm lost in thought now.
Well, I just think it's ultimately much more successful when you have the opportunity to have that conversation in person. I don't think that Twitter is helping us out in any way for like bridging that divide, or mm-hmm. allowing for more authentic conversation.
Exactly.
It really just makes things worse much of the time.
Definitely.
And
that's why,
you know, whatever. It ends up being more of like a show.
Yeah.
I
think that's definitely why I switched focus to just showing art I like online, you know?
I've noticed that.
You know, because it becomes pointless. You want to say something that is almost a throwaway comment. You want to be like, yeah, you know, Captain America movie, way better than any Captain America comic. And it's like a throwaway comment. You're not even thinking too hard about it. You're not really caring too much that you're ruining some creator's career because you didn't like his comic.
Mm-hmm.
And it ends up becoming this ferocious debate where it's just like, are you serious? Like, can I have an opinion without having to write a thesis on it? And more often when I am going to write something that is more of like a lengthy essay, I will write it now on my blog that I made specifically just for these type of conversations. And if I'm going to have a throwaway comment, I just make it, I don't really need to say that comment. I'll just, here's some nice art, you know, because.
But aren't you then sort of policing yourself?
Yeah. Well, I'm policing myself from getting frustrated at stupid people.
You know? Like, okay, so it's still, like, coming for, like, it's for your benefit then. So it's
yeah. And I think that's a lot of times when people are like, oh, why do you delete my comments? That was one of the things I've gotten most recently. And it's just like, because this is for myself. You know, like, a Facebook is not a real identity. Twitter is not a real identity. None of your points are well-formed points if you're constructing them on the fly in a Facebook status. And I think this is what you need. Like, I think these armchair critics who are writing like 140-character responses to who is and who is not hip-hop is just like, you can't make a good point in that structure. Mm-hmm. And if you really care about your point, then you'd stop making those points. And that's why I stopped. Because I had to I'm figuring this out as I go.
Right.
Well, can we talk about something happy for a second then, since we're going to police ourselves, I guess?
Sure.
I'm really fucking happy right now. Don't take this away from me, Aaron. I'm happy.
This is something to be happy about. I mean, we always like to kind of end things on and ask what you're reading. What are you enjoying, comics, prose, I don't know, TV-wise, things you want to suggest to the audience that we need to be aware of at the moment?
Let me see. I'm going to look at my to-do list. Because it has what I'm supposed to be reading.
Okay.
Where is it? So I recently started a to-do list after seeing Eric's to-do list, which is like this kind of amazing machine of efficiency. So I was like, I'm going to adopt this system. And he puts everything he has to do on there, even like the smallest thing, like, hey, read this book you've been meaning to read. So right here I have Finish Mobius's Inkyle, which I've never read.
Mm-hmm.
Read do you know this artist Leo?
Mm-mm.
He does this book called Aldebaran and Beetlejuice. They're like these really cool sci-fi books. He's a Brazilian artist.
Oh.
Then I have to read Very Casual by Michael DeForge.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. Oh, okay. Oh, and I have to write write Riddick fanfic on here.
So you would put that on the everyone else needs to read your Riddick fanfic.
Oh, I wish they would. But at the same time, there's almost like a secret, there's a pleasure in knowing that no one's really reading it. Because it's just so I wrote it the first day, and then I rewrote the whole first chapter, posted it again. And it was like the same amount of people who liked it the first time liked it. And I'm just like, wow, no one cares about this character as much as I do. It's such a niche combination of combining Les Miserables with Judge Dredd and Riddick. But to me, I'm just like, no, this is perfect. Why can't I have $1 zillion to fund this?
that's the problem with art. No, it's never appreciated in its time.
Yeah, and I just feel like I'm going to be this eccentric little old man who is just like it's going to hire Carl Urban to come to my house and sing the Les Miserables soundtrack. I'm like, no. Put more vibrato in that.
I like the fanfic of you hiring Carl Urban to come to your house.
Right.
I want to hire somebody to draw that team up book.
Oh, that'd be so good. I really
want the Ulysses Farinas Carl Urban team up book?
Mm-hmm.
There's a few actors that I love to just spend the day with, like, you know, eating lunch, you know, throwing sand at each other on the beach and giggling. Just.
I can see the montage. Who else besides Carl Urban?
Like in a One Direction video?
Mm-hmm. I want to be on the beach and like a cute girl walk by and we both put our shades down at the same time and then give each other like a thumbs up like, yeah.
Who's on that list? Like who are the top three?
Vin Diesel.
Oh, of course.
Robert Redford is probably in there.
Like right now Robert Redford or like 1960s Robert Redford?
Time Lord Robert Redford, like no
right.
Tom Cruise, I would like to hang out with, even though everyone thinks he's crazy. He looks crazy, but at the same time, he looks like, I don't know, I always feel like he's kind of genuine. And it's just weird, because people think he looks very manufactured. But to me, I think, there's this one video that someone like sprayed water on him, and he grabs the guy, and he says, well, why would you do that? And he like actually stops and talks to the guy, like, why would you do that? Like, that's like, that's just not even really funny. It's just kind of like I stopped to talk to you just to say hi, and you're going to spray water in my face. And the guy's like, oh, it was a joke. And he's like, yeah, whatever, man. You know, it's just like kind of a a moment where it's like, oh, he's real. And I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I like to see like Vin Diesel singing to his daughter, and I just like things like that.
No, I think those would all be great outings. I want to watch that reality show
one day
when you've made it, when you reach the pinnacle.
That's it. That's the answer to that earlier question. What's the goal?
Is getting to spend days with those people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, you could have some sort of like cancer or something and make that your make a wish.
Jeez.
Oh my God, Aaron.
Really dark, real fast.
Well, holy shit. I had to bring it back. Look. Wow. Look, you work hard, I work smart.
With cancer?
Well, I'm just saying, you don't have to do much.
It's like the worst thing you've ever said, and you said a lot of really shitty things.
Oh, I see how it is. See, this goes back to that whole, the culture of homogenization. You guys are keeping me down. I'm just making a joke.
Yep.
And you guys just jump all over me.
Too far.
Yep. A guy can't say you should die of cancer so you can hang out with your idols, and you guys suddenly attack me?
Can't get down with that one.
Wow.
Nope.
Well, I guess I reached.
I am formally denouncing that. So no one has any doubt.
We found your line.
This is real Ulysses Farinas, not persona, not Facebook, not cancer.
Well, on that note, thank you, Ulysses, for joining us on the couch this week. Thank you to all of you for listening to another episode of Comics Therapy. Don't forget to pre-order your comics at your local shop and subscribe to them digitally. Show notes and other details are on our site, as always, comicstherapy.com. See you next week.
They paved paradise, put up a parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. It paved